nicely and well done. Nice song there. Exodus chapter 14 is where we'll start. Exodus 14. In the next several weeks, I would like to preach a series to you that's taken from a book written here by Robert J. Morgan called The Red Sea Rules. Anybody ever seen this book? Okay, a number of you have. If you haven't, it's an easy read, but I thought it was very well done, drawing 10 lessons or rules, as it were, as to how to see a problem when we face it in our lives, and how to approach it with faith. And as he says, the same God who led you in will lead you out. And so we're going to preach a series on the Red Sea Rules, meaning rules for life taken from the Red Sea encounter. And this evening, I just want to give an intro to that and start us into it. In Exodus chapter 14, now recently, in our stories that children should know, we've touched on this, but let's begin in Exodus chapter number 14 and verse number 1. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, that they turn and encamp before Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, over against Baal-Zephon, before it ye shall encamp by the sea. Now, he's giving them very specific directions. Now, it may be a little bit difficult for us now to pinpoint where that location was. Next week, I hope to give you a little bit more detail on the possibility and some intriguing aspects of that. But you can see here in the text that he's giving them distinct direction to a specific place. So in other words, God wants them right there, to encamp right there. Now notice verse number 3. For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are entangled in the land. The wilderness hath shut them in. So they are boxed in some way in the place that God has directed them to go. Verse 4, and I will harden Pharaoh's heart, that he shall follow after them, and I will be honored upon Pharaoh and upon all his host, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. And they did so. And it was told the king of Egypt that the people fled, and the heart of Pharaoh and of his servants was turned against the people. And they said, Why have we done this, that we have let Israel go from serving us? And he made ready his chariot and took his people with him. And he took 600 chosen chariots and all the chariots of Egypt and captains over every one of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued after the children of Israel. And the children of Israel went out with an high hand. You remember, they had left essentially looting the people of Egypt as they left, not by busting out the windows of their homes and running in and stealing and snatch and grab. They would ask them for things, and they were so ready to get rid of the Israelites that they were giving them things. They were loading them up, and so they leave rich people with gold and jewelry and whatever else it may be that they obtained from the Egyptians along the way. It says they went out with an high hand. But verse 9, the Egyptians pursued after them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them encamping by the sea beside Pi-Hahiroth before Baal-Zephon. Now, that's exactly where God told them to be. And now now Pharaoh, with this, if you will, world-famous army at the time, the world power, approaches with his entire army and begins to envelop the Israelite people in this place where they were buttoned in to the geography there. And when Pharaoh drew nigh, verse 10, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians march after them, and they were sore afraid, and the children of Israel cried unto the Lord. Now again, you imagine that place where they are, where you've come out with a high hand, and in the midst of your jubilation and exaltation and that sense of joyous victory, you turn around from your encampment and you begin to see the army coming, and almost instantaneously, that joyfulness and that exaltation turns to major doubt and question. Everything I thought I had believed up to this point, and everything I thought that God was doing, was now in question, because they turn around and they are indeed buttoned in by Pharaoh's army. There's nowhere to go. There's a sea on one hand that's too deep and too wide to ford. There's possibly cliffs on the other side. It leaves them with no way out. And that's exactly where God wanted them. To recognize that there's times in life where God, in the place to which God leads you, you face a difficulty that makes you doubt the things that you believe, that brings you under a significant burden, a stress, an affliction, a pressure, and you begin to question and doubt. What do you do when you obviously see that to your eyes, and humanly speaking, there is no way out? Have you ever felt like that before? If you have, then you're like someone else in Scripture. If you turn to Psalm number 77, Psalm 77 is a psalm by the man named Asaph. It'd be interesting to do a study on the man Asaph. He was essentially a chief musician in that economy and in the temple. And he wrote this psalm, which is very transparent, born out of his heart, and shows us what he went through at a certain point in his life. He says in Psalm 77, verse number 1, I cried unto God with my voice, even unto God with my voice, and he gave ear unto me. In the day of my trouble, that affliction, that pressure, that narrow sense where I don't know where to go and the walls are closing in, I sought the Lord. He says, my sore ran in the night and ceased not. It's the picture of a man with hands outspread, whether he's sprawled on the ground or his hands are raised in the air. He constantly continues to raise his hands to the Lord, to pray, to cry out, my soul refused to be comforted. Interesting how things seem to hit us harder at night, isn't it? Whether it's a cold, every time you have a cold or a sinus infection or a temperature, you might be feel kind of good throughout the day, and boy, evening comes on and you get to feeling worse, and when it's darkest and quietest is when there's the most pain and the difficulty, and it's taking away your sleep, and sometimes it's in very serious ways. Now I mentioned a cold, but those night times of life when truly at night you're sitting on the side of your bed, your hands outstretched, as it were. You're crying out to God for that grace, that help. And the questions begin to come. Maybe it's a relationship issue. You know, somebody said when you make the decision to have kids, you've decided to let your heart live outside of your body for the rest of your life. You've created extensions of yourself that are nerve endings, as it were. And something happens to your children and it happens to you. You feel it. And when it happens to their kids, it happens to you. Maybe it's a financial burden. Maybe it's your own physical pain. Your own physical pain. You can't sleep. And it aches so bad. Oh God, I'm losing sleep. And how can I exist this way? And how can I go on and on? And you cry out to God. It could be one of a thousand things that's keeping you up in the night. He says, my sore ran in the night and ceased not. My soul refused to be comforted. I remembered God. I called God to remembrance in this time when I was sitting on the side of my bed aching and thoughts were swirling and I was in this storm. He says, I remembered God and was troubled. I was troubled. I complained. Now, the word complained is the same word which sometimes is seen as meditate. I think that would be a good perspective of it here when he says, I remembered God and was troubled. I complained, that is, deep inside myself, I meditated, I thought. Sometimes if you look up in a lexicon, they'll give you a variety of different meanings, and you go, really, how could it mean that? And they even say murmur, you know. Oh, what murmur and meditation and complain? But you know when something's so deep inside of you and you're thinking about it and it causes such an internal response that maybe you begin to audibly make noise or talk to yourself or murmur or talk out loud even though nobody's there. That's what he's doing. He's remembering God. He's thinking a lot of things deeply, down deep there. And he says, I was overwhelmed. I don't know if that's good. It doesn't seem good necessarily. We would want to say in our happy days that we remember God and everything lightens up. But not for Asaph. I was struggling. I was calling out to God. My soul wouldn't be comforted. I thought about God, and I meditated on things that I should know, and yet I was still troubled and overwhelmed. Selah. Verse 4 says, thou holdest mine eyes waking. Interesting construction as I looked at it in the original is something that basically, you hold my eyelids from my eyes. Holding my eyelids from my, in other words, it's like he's holding your eyes open. He can't close his eyes, as it were. Thou holdest mine eyes waking. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. Have you ever been there? If you haven't, maybe you're going to be. And that's why you're going to need to listen. Because, again, it's part of why we like the Psalms, isn't it? Because it says, yeah, that's so real. Right, he's really showing us how life is sometimes. I am so troubled that I cannot speak. And what does he do? I've considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. You know, it's interesting to think that when we're struggling and when we're doubting, one of the best places to go is to a history book. A history book. And the greatest of history books is this right here. Why? Because it tells us what God has done over and over again, how he's acted here and how he's shown himself strong there, and what it's taught us about God as we've seen him work through history. So it sounds like maybe we want an inspirational devotional. We want chicken soup for the soul, but we look into a history book, into what God did in ancient times. And he says in verse number 6, I call to remembrance my song in the night. And I hope soon, too, to be doing a series on songs in the night. I commune with mine own heart, and my spirit made diligent search. You can see his mind is racing. He's thinking, and thoughts are washing here and there, and God's in the mix, but it doesn't really seem to help. The end result is he's overwhelmed. He's so troubled he can't speak. He can't see his way out of it. He's probably exhausted. He's not seeing the answer, but he begins to ask questions, a lot of questions. Will the Lord cast off forever? And will he be favorable no more? Is his mercy clean gone forever? Doth his promise fail forevermore? Now, what was going on in Asaph's life? What was he struggling with? You know, I thought about this, that if he was grieving over something nationally, for the Israelite people, it was kind of all bound up in one. If you're struggling with something nationally, you're kind of struggling with something theologically, and you're struggling with something familially because you're all the same family. You're all the nation. And so maybe he's aching and grieving over something that he's seeing going on in the country, or the corruption that he sees, or a coming attack that he sees, or the apathy of his people, or maybe it's something in his own life that grieves him. Again, maybe it's a physical ailment. But he's asking these questions. Will the Lord cast off forever? Is his mercy clean gone forever? Doth his promise fail forevermore? Hath God forgotten to be gracious? Hath he in anger shut up his tender mercies? One preacher said he's asking so many questions that he can't hear the answer, that we don't stop to listen. And you know, I could stop with each one of these, and I could give verses, and we could list out scriptural citations that answer those questions. But sometimes, have you been there where you know the right answer? You know, you've read it long enough. You know what should comfort you, and yet you're asking these kind of questions. Here's the chief singer, the one, you know, the psalmist saying, has God forgotten to be gracious? In other words, has he set aside his grace? Has he in anger shut up his tender mercies? Is his mercy clean gone forever? Well, of course not. He's a covenant God. He's made promises. He's faithful and always will be. And we could tell him these things. Maybe he's telling them to himself, but it's not helping. But verse 10, we begin to see as this psalm goes on a progress there. I said, verse 10, this is my infirmity. I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. Now you'll note that in the English text it includes, but I will remember. If I read the verse without that, and I said, this is my infirmity, the years. Let me find my place again. This is my infirmity, the years of the right hand of the Most High. Possibly what he's saying there is to say that this infirmity that's come upon me has lasted for a while, and it's come from the right hand of God. It's been something that God has given to me, and it's lasted for some time. Verse 11, I will remember the works of the Lord. Now, I'm going to call something to my mind. I thought about God, and it wasn't at some point of the turmoil, it wasn't helping. And in all my questions that I was firing, I was so troubled and overwhelmed. But now I will remember the works of the Lord. Surely I will remember the wonders of old. I will meditate also of all thy work and talk of thy doings. I don't even know that he means to talk to anybody else. Talk to himself in his meditation. To begin to recite to himself the things that he knows about God and the things that he knows from Scripture and the things that he's heard and learned and known that have been embedded in his heart. He will meditate on these things, and that will begin to stir in his heart. He begins to realize, verse 13, thy way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Who is so great a God as our God? Interesting. Again, the construction there, the sanctuary. Think about the sanctuary. Your way is in that set-apart place, the sanctuary. If I want to know you, I go to that sanctuary, and then when it says, who is so great as our God, I remember a little bit the construction as I studied it in the original, but it's like to say, from other gods, your God. You know, you're just as you are separate from other gods, and so the way I seek you is a separate and a unique place. I go to the sanctuary to worship you. Your way is in the sanctuary. Who is so great a God as our God? And good question to ask in a time like that. Thou art the God that doest wonders. Thou hast declared thy strength among the people. How has he declared his strength? Oh, goodness. Well, we could start a list. We could start writing now and go for a while, but he lists some here. He's going to begin to reiterate certain pieces of history. Verse 15, thou hast with thine arm redeemed thy people, the sons of Jacob and Joseph, Selah. Now, the classic story of the redemption of God's people was Egypt. Egypt. That's referred to over and over and over again in Scripture, that I am the Lord that delivered you from Egypt. Now notice he goes on. The waters saw thee. He's describing something that he knows from history of how God showed his power when he redeemed his people. The waters saw thee, O God. The waters saw thee. They were afraid. The depths also were troubled. It's the water was agitated at your presence and at your working. The clouds poured out water. The sky sent out a sound. Of course, that's thunder. Thine arrows also went abroad. That would be lightning. The voice of thy thunder was in the heaven. The lightnings lightened the world. The earth trembled and shook. Thy way is in the sea, and thy path in the great waters. And thy footsteps are not known. Thou leddest thy people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. Now, what is he referring to? There is a possibility that he's remembering the Exodus from Egypt and the path through the Red Sea. That with power you showed your strength when you delivered your people. and the waters were troubled, and your path was in the sea. Interesting. Interesting. He's so troubled he cannot speak. Whatever phase of life this is, and wherever he is in the chronology and the timeline, he looks back in history and he remembers the Red Sea, potentially, I think what he could be mentioning here. And if he is, by the way, it seems to give us a little bit of context, a little extra detail to that event. How have you pictured it in your mind? You know, oftentimes you hear a story, you add certain details in your own imagination. Maybe we see it it's a nice sunny day, the breeze is blowing, here comes the Egyptian army, and then Moses raises his rod and the waters part. But remember, it says that the cloud removed from Israel and went in between them and Pharaoh and became a pillar of fire. And then the context tells us in Exodus that it was nighttime. It was nighttime as they crossed. Now notice the text in Psalms here. The clouds, verse 17, the clouds poured out water. The skies sent out a sound. Thine arrows also went abroad. The voice of thy thunder was in the heaven. The lightnings lightened the world. The earth trembled and shook. We know that the winds blew all night. You wonder if there might have been a storm, if there was lightning and thunder and crashing and the earth shaking as God was working to make a way through the sea. And I hadn't thought about this until just recently when somebody else mentioned it. We might think in our minds that here came the sea and went whoop, and it opened like a book, and they saw the other side, and they went marching down the middle of the sea. I wonder if it was still a bit dark as they saw that sea opened up and the waters peeled back like a wall. Maybe they couldn't see all the way across. Now think about the level of faith that it might take. Are you sure you want to go into that? I see water here, and I see maybe some water over there, and I know there's dry ground right here, but I'm not sure where it goes. Am I going to walk in the middle of that sea? Am I going to take that step of faith? But he says, thy way is in the sea, and thy path in the great waters. Thy footsteps are not known. Interesting to think in a sense of God walking through the sea. You can't see his footsteps. But God leading his people and delivering them through the Red Sea. And he finishes verse 20. Thou ledest thy people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. And he stops. This transparent look into this dark, dark night of the man Asaph, who was so troubled with possibly a long-standing struggle. As thoughts washed around in his heart and he tried to think about God and he was overwhelmed. He couldn't even talk. It's like his hands are stretched constantly crying out to God. And finally, he begins to dig down deep and remember that history. And he goes to, it seems like, the deliverance from Egypt and the crossing of the Red Sea. And understanding that God who led when there was no way out, that God did it. He made a way. The God that specifically put them in that little nook of the world where they were boxed in on purpose. And God may put you there on purpose to be flanked by the Egyptian army, rocks on one side, water on the other, and you look at God. And you begin to wonder and cry out in the night, God, there's nowhere to go. There is nowhere to go. And now what are you going to do? Are you going to doubt? Are you going to begin to question his mercy? Are you going to begin to be terrified and impugn his character? Or are you going to remember that the God who led me in by his design will lead me out? And he'll do it in whatever magnificent way he wants. And he'll get himself glory in the process. I simply need to stop and watch the working of the Lord and move forward by faith one step at a time, trusting in this God who could deliver his people at the Red Sea. Most certainly, he can provide for me an answer. And whatever this sore that runs in the night, whatever this grief that overwhelms me and you, God, the God who leads you in, can lead you out. And so as we continue in the weeks to come, we'll look at various aspects of that story and the truths that we can garner from it as we approach these difficulties of life, these deep tribulations.